We did not quite complete the introduction to Genesis 39 last time, but we'll do that now, and we should be able to complete the whole chapter. Remember, the theme of Genesis 39 is the success of Joseph, and it breaks into three parts. We have him in verses 1 through 6, successful in the house of Potiphar. In 7 down through 18, we have him showing success in temptation. And then in verses 20 through 23, success in prison. In the house, in the prison, and finally, he will be into the palace of Pharaoh. We also noted, and this was the last thing we did, that there is structure to chapter 39. And the structure is the first part, verses 1 through 6, and the last part, 21 through 23, frame the temptation. And they frame it by being similar, the first and the last, in three areas. Chapter 39, verse 4, the first part speaks of the Lord's presence with Joseph. When we complete the chapter and he's in prison, verses 21 through 23, emphasis on the Lord's presence. The trust of Potiphar is found in verse 6, the trust of the jailer in verse 23. The text speaks of Joseph finding grace in the eyes of Potiphar in verse 4 and grace in the eyes of the jailer, verse 21. So this all frames what is central in it, which is the temptation. That, in turn, breaks down two ways. The first temptation and refusal in verses 7 through 9. The first temptation and refusal ends with Potiphar's wife alerting the household slaves that Joseph has approached her. The second temptation comes on a daily basis, and it is met with refusal, and then you have the two accusations before the servants and before her husband. Final point by way of introduction, and that is the transitional events in these chapters. Okay, transitional events in Genesis 39 through 41. The transitional events that move Joseph into the palace of Pharaoh and see him end up as prime minister of Egypt. And the first movement gets him from the house of Potiphar to prison. From house to prison. And the means of getting him from the house to the prison is false accusation. As we said last time, Joseph is a good study in the fact that it doesn't make any difference whether good things or bad things happen to the believer. God is able to make them all work together for good. And so, I would say that in chapter 40, you've got two synergeo events. Synergeo is the word that is used, remember, in Romans 8:28, all things work together, or he works all things together. And the first one is in chapter 40 and verse 1. He now is in prison, and you have the first evidence that things are going to work together for good. As he was placed in prison, you have chapter 40, verse 1. And this is the event that God controls, God brings together in order to bring Joseph into the house of Pharaoh. It came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt, and they get thrown in prison along with Joseph. And that event comes about first. The second synergeo event is in 40 and verse 8. In 40 and verse 8, these high officials said to him, that is Joseph, "We have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it." Then Joseph said to them, Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. And he interprets the event. That is the thing that moves him from prison to palace. The event that moves him from prison to palace. And if it was the false accusation that moved him from the house to prison, from the prison to the palace, the event is the memory of the cupbearer. The cupbearer remembers that when they were in prison, Joseph was able to interpret his dream. And the first Sunergeo event that deals with that is 41:1. It says, it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And the way things will work together is that Pharaoh will not understand the meaning of his dream, and the cupbearer will remember that his dream had been interpreted by Joseph, and therefore he recommends him. The second Sunergeo event is 41:12-13. The words read, he says, "Now a Hebrew youth was with us there in jail, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, and we related them to him. And he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came about that just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office," that's the cupbearer, "but he hanged him." And therefore, Pharaoh, calls in Joseph to interpret his dream, and when that happens, you have the elevation of Joseph to the place of prime minister in Egypt. Those are all transitional events handled by the sovereignty of God. Two more points of introduction. In chapter 39, injustice won the day. Chapter 39, injustice won the day. Injustice. Joseph, however, won the battle. The false accusations were nothing but tools in the hand of God. And as we said, the events in these chapters are really a study in the Greek word synergeo, how God makes all things to fit together. Final point of introduction, and now we're focusing on 39. Genesis 39 fulfills two major purposes relative to Joseph. Chapter 39 fulfills two purposes relative to Joseph. The first one is in Potiphar's house. If you go back to chapter 39, where will be the rest of the study. When you go to chapter 39, verse 4 says, "Joseph found favor in his sight, and he became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge." So that in Potiphar's house, he learns business administration. In Potiphar's house, he learns administration, how to run a household. Later on, the administration of all of Egypt will be placed in Joseph's hands. Good example of how Joseph was faithful in the small things, a single household, and because he was faithful and learned in small things, he is eventually elevated to run the whole country. The second purpose that is fulfilled relative to Joseph is in prison. He prepares for leadership without pride. In prison, he prepares for leadership without the danger of pride. Can you imagine the humiliation that Joseph experienced in prison? What are you here for? Tried to rape the Secretary of State's wife. And that would be humiliating. And he would learn in those circumstances, though he is destined for leadership, he had to go through some humiliation. This, again, would illustrate that humiliation before exaltation is the picture. All right, now let's go to the details. Roman numeral number one, Joseph's success. And as we said, every one of the three sections will underscore the idea of success. Joseph's success in the house of this leader, Potiphar, 39, 1 through 6. And the author of Genesis begins in verse 1 with a review. Verse 1 says, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and the had been taken leaps over chapter 38, and chapter 38 doesn't have any of Joseph in it. In fact, in one sense of the word, chapter 38 is about Judah and Tamar, has nothing to do with Joseph whatsoever. But as you remember, the life of Joseph started in chapter 37. So we've got chapter 37 that introduces his life, then we leap over chapter 38 with Judah and Tamar, and now we're ready to pick up with the life of Joseph again. And consequently, the way the chapter starts is, now do you remember, when we left off a chapter ago, here's where we were. And therefore, chapter 39 and verse 1 is a review. And it's necessary because of the interruption of chapter 38. So the review is necessary because of the interruption of chapter 38. Now, that is made forceful by the wording of the Hebrew text. We have said many times that the Hebrew language always observes a word order. The word order is, and since Hebrew reads the opposite of English, I'll put it down that way. The word order that you meet in Hebrew is first the verb, then the subject, and then the object. For example, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, is normal word order. It says, Bereshit, in the beginning, then bara, the verb, God, Elohim, heavens and the earth, Hashemayim Eretz, as the direct object. So, created God, the heavens and the earth, and that's normal Hebrew word order. Whenever they want to emphasize, however, and underscore one part, they rearranged it. And chapter 39, verse 1, begins with a rearranged order. It begins subject, verb, object. And so the subject has been moved to the front part, and therefore it is the emphatic word. And therefore the subject, and you see it in English, is Joseph. And that is the stress. So we might paraphrase verse 1 by saying something like this. Now, getting back to Joseph, who had been taken down to Egypt. So there's a big flag in verse 1 with the Hebrew emphatic noun, proper noun, Joseph, that he's now the focal point of the study once again. Now, as for Joseph, that we left off back in chapter 37, the one that had been sold down to Egypt and so forth. Now, in this chapter, we are going to see two things about Joseph that will be demonstrated. And the two features in the life of Joseph is, number one, we're going to prove his moral character. His moral character is proved by the incident with Potiphar's wife. And this will test and prove the moral character of Joseph. So his moral character is proved by his response to sexual temptation. Moral character proved by his response to sexual temptation. It's interesting, the setting for that is going to be the last sentence in verse 6. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Very interesting to put two men side by side, both of which the Bible says they were good looking. You know the other man that was said to be good looking? David. And so you've got Joseph and you've got David, both of whom are said to have been physically good looking. I think we mentioned that in verse 6, when it says Joseph was handsome, the Hebrew translation of that is well built. He was well built in form and in appearance. And you have an interesting contrast. The moral character of Joseph was proved by his victory in sexual temptation. The downfall of David began with his failure in 2 Samuel 12 in sexual temptation, which, though he was forgiven, if you study David after the incident with Bathsheba, everything goes downhill. His family, everything is downhill from that point on. So we're going to have a moral character of this man proved. And again, the thing that's remarkable about it is the fact that he's 17, probably 18 at the time, and therefore of strong character. That's the first thing that's proved, his moral character. The second thing that's demonstrated in chapter 39 is his administrative capability. And if the incident with Potiphar's wife in 7 through 19 demonstrates his moral quality or moral character, then two things in chapter 39 demonstrate his administrative capability. The first is in the house where he set over all of Potiphar's household. The second is in prison, but ends the chapter where the jailer doesn't even supervise him, but makes him a supervisor in the jail. So both of these things are going to come out here in the life of Joseph. So his success, first, review. Second, summary. Verse 2. I think we mentioned before that you can demonstrate in the Hebrew Old Testament over and over and over again this kind of structure. Headline summary followed by detail. And we've got it right here. Notice verse 2 is a headlines, it's a summary, and the details of it follow. So think of verse 2 as the headlines over the article giving the details about the character of Joseph. So verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. So he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. That's what the whole thing is about. So we'll put summary, which is going to say, in Hebrew style, what chapter 39 is all about. Namely, Joseph made successful by God. That's the whole theme. Joseph made successful by God. The details then follow in verses 3 through 6. Details 3 through 6. We might emphasize once again by seeing it in the text that verse 2 really does introduce the theme of success. You've got it in verse 2. If you go down to verse 5, it came about from the time that he made him overseer in his house over all that he owned, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. You have the same thing emphasized down at verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph. You have the same thing in verse 23. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made him to prosper. So that is very much the theme that is there. Now, when you come down, really what this says is the only thing that really matters in the life of Joseph or any believer's life is relationship with God. And as long as that is maintained, whatever happens to him is somewhat insignificant. We might add, when Joseph came down to Egypt, what a dramatic change in his environment was. Joseph had been a shepherd. And as a shepherd, he'd been rural. And now, as he is sold into Egypt, he comes down and he would see the camel trains with the wealth of the world. As he comes into Egypt, he would see thriving cities. The Great Pyramid had been there 1,000 years when Joseph, it was old, it was ancient when Joseph came to Egypt. And therefore, you're taking this man from, at age 17, from a rural life and plopping him right in the middle of the metropolis of all world civilization at that time. And that is the scene that he comes into. And the key, really, is how he is successful in the midst of adverse circumstances. Now, notice we had the concept back at verse 3 that God blessed, or verse 4, rather, God blessed, no, rather verse 5, God blessed the house of Potiphar because of Joseph. Can you think what that fulfills? Go back to Genesis 12. Genesis 12. The blessing on Potiphar is a fulfillment. I didn't say the. A fulfillment of the blessing curses, a blessing and cursing prediction. And the blessing cursing prediction was simply this. When God made a covenant with Abraham, he said, those that bless Abraham and his seed, I will bless. Those that curse him, I will curse. And therefore, you come down to the Abrahamic covenant and verse 3, I will bless those who bless you. And I think we have a clear indication. Potiphar blessed a seed of Israel and Joseph, and God blessed the household of Potiphar. And the one who curses you, I will curse. Remember how that is fleshed out really in detail in the book of Ezekiel, how God turns to Tyre and the surrounding nations of Israel and says, here's what's happening to you because of the way you treated my people. And most of those, of course, are judgment. So I think we can fairly say, down in verse 5, the blessing on Potiphar's house is very much a fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, the part that promises blessing and cursing, dependent upon how Israel's treated, and here how the seed of Abraham is treated within this context. Verse 4, we ought to stop and note, just in your imagination as much as possible, what a compliment to the dependability of Joseph verse 4 is. Can you think of anybody to whom you would, without any question, commit everything you have on this earth and never worry about it? Joseph, verse 4, found favor in his sight, became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. Can you imagine taking your name off of your CDs, your name off the title of your house, and saying it's yours, and it's not even a family member? That speaks very highly for the enormous dependability of Joseph, which obviously what he was. Now, one other question we ought to ask in these verses and try to get an answer to. And this is... I lost it. Oh, verse 3. His master Potiphar saw that the Lord was with him. How did he know that? Was there any knowledge of Yahweh in Egypt? Not really. I think the most feasible answer is in verse 3, Potiphar knew that the prosperity was from the Lord because Joseph told him so. Very possible that Joseph said, you know, it's Yahweh, the Lord that I serve, and whatever blessing comes our way is because of a relationship with him. So it's very possible that verse 3 is talking about the witness of Joseph, and Joseph had very flatly and openly said the blessing is here because of the relationship with Yahweh. All right? Now, notice in verse 6. Verse 6, we have a transitional statement that is the setting for verses 7 through 19. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and that is the threshold to his second success. First success in the house, and now success of Joseph in temptation. Success of Joseph in temptation. 39:7-19. And let's start by giving some reasons for yielding that Joseph might have brought up. The temptation comes on immediately in verse 7. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, "Lie with me." Notice she's not very direct in the context. And suppose you were Joseph. Can you think of reasons for yielding? Well, in the first place, I didn't approach her. She was the initiator. What if Joseph had been the kind of person that didn't accept responsibility and always had some kind of an excuse for his actions? I never once approached that woman. She approached me. And that ought to make my yielding a little more understandable. But Joseph was a totally responsible person. It didn't make any difference that he was approached. The point was, it was not to be done, and Joseph was responsible. But he could have used a possible excuse at that point. A second. Do you think Potiphar's wife would have told? Let's say she was very unlikely to tell. She was not likely to tell. Or we might put it this way. Could Joseph have gotten away with it? Probably. He probably could have gotten away with it. But Joseph didn't have that kind of mentality. Joseph's mentality was not, "Can I get away with it?" Joseph is going to see something else that we'll look at in just a moment. Third, yielding would have been easy. Yielding would have been easy. Look down, for example, at verse 11. The time came when there was nobody there that would have known. Chapter 39, verse 11. It happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. The environment was perfect. You couldn't have asked for a better environment. And Joseph could have used that. He could have said, as we have said, "I didn't start this. She did. She is not likely to tell. The psychological setting of it is proper. Nobody will know. The environment is just right," in verse 11. Fourth, the temptation was powerful for two reasons, or several reasons. The temptation was powerful. Let's not underplay that. That's important. And it was a strong temptation because it was bold, as we noticed in verse 7. It was not innuendo. It was direct. And it was day after day. It was persistent. She did not, verse 1 or verse 7, did not occur at one time. It occurred many times. And therefore, that helps us to see a little bit of what Joseph is really up against. This is a potent thing. She is bold. Lie with me. That's direct. Though that might seem as a euphemism in English, but nonetheless, it was clearly understood. It was bold. It was direct. And she did this day after day, persistent. That's the kind of temptation that he had to put up with. And Joseph could have well said, well, I've said no, 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 1,000 times. Then I said yes. And could have argued, well, perhaps then you're not looking at my wonderful track record of how many times the answer was no, until I was simply worn down with this persistent day in, day out type of thing. That was not part of Joseph's mentality in any sense of the word. Fifth, even though it was not written yet, Joseph's conduct beautifully matched the instruction of Proverbs 5. Proverbs 5. Proverbs 5. In Proverbs 5, Solomon is describing the adulteress, begins the chapter by saying, "My son, give attention to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding that you may observe discretion, and your lips reserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey." And the imagery of honey would be the idea of pleasant to the taste. And I'm sure we can be sure that Joseph experienced that type of thing. It's also described as her speech is smoother than oil. The idea of oil would be the smoothness, the flattery of it. The appeal would naturally be there to the male ego, which only a male would really understand, but it was there. And then in verse 4, you have one of the afterwards of Proverbs. I believe there are 8 of them. And they're introduced by a single Hebrew word that is translated afterwards, but comes across in our New American by saying, "but in the end." And we have been over in the study of Proverbs the fact that there are 8 afterwards in Proverbs, and how that many never consider the afterwards of a thought, the afterwards of an action, the afterwards of a lifestyle. And in verse 4, afterwards, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword, her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life, her ways are unstable. And that describes her corruption. You ever stop to think if Joseph, either way he went, was going to jail? If he had done it, where would he end up? In jail. If he didn't yield, where would he end up? Where'd he end up? In jail. So there's no difference. Yes, there is. What's the difference? Had he yielded, he would have gone to jail in fellowship without the blessing of God. He did the right thing and went to jail with the blessing of God. And therefore, you have a good example of no matter what the outcome may be, if it's the same in both cases, there is a difference. And the difference is in the blessing of God that is present, so that the blessing of God removed would have been far worse than the blessing of God that was given by his refusing to yield. Notice, by the way, in chapter 5, verse 6, her proposal of adultery is a revelation of her life, of her character. She doesn't ponder the path of life, verse 6. Her ways are unstable. She does not know it. Now, what is the instruction given in Proverbs? Verse 7, "Now then, my sons, listen to me. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her. do not go near the door of her house. In other words, he is described as, in fact, the word translated keep in verse 8 is a word that's used over and over and over in the Old Testament for physical distance. Keep your distance from the door of her house. Do not go near it. It obviously means don't go in, but don't even go near. Don't play close to the edge, which is the command that we have down in verse 8. The word way, of course, refers to one's path of life, all the activities one is in, and he's not to go close to the edge. Now, leaving that, back to Genesis 39. verse 12. Now, it is true, there was no Proverbs for Joseph to relate to, but if the proverb statement of don't go near is true, then it was also true in the times of Joseph, though obviously not written in the book of Proverbs. And notice the way he handles the whole thing down in verse 12. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. Joseph did just exactly what the scripture says is to be done. Joseph obviously also lived in a keen sense of fellowship with the Lord and his responsibility to him. And notice that in responding to her, Joseph makes 3 points. Verse 7. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Boy, this is simple. But he refused. Notice, to the point, there is no playing with the issue. There's no discussing the issue. There's no, now, don't you want to consider the issue? Joseph said no. He refused. And said to his master's wife, quote, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in his house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great evil and sin against God? Notice in his response of Joseph, or the points that he makes, just call them Joseph's points, there are three of them, to Potiphar's wife. Doesn't do any good, but he makes the points, and there are three that are found in these words. Number one, he emphasizes the baseness of betraying a trust. The baseness of betraying a trust. He is simply saying, Potiphar has entrusted everything to me. How can I break that trust? That's not his whole argument, but that's a large part of his argument. And I think you can agree, is it not so, that the greater the confidence given, the baser the betrayal of that trust would be? And Joseph grasped that. This man has trusted me, and I will not engage in the baseness of betraying him. And it's the first point that Joseph makes in verse 8. My master does not concern himself with anything in the house. He has put all that he owns in my charge. And I will not betray that trust. Is Joseph going to be a good prime minister? Is he going to be a leader? Absolutely. Ready at age 18. Second, he points this to her. She is morally off bounds to him. She is morally off bounds. And notice how that is stated. He's very clear and very concise. Verse 8. No, verse 9 rather. There is no one greater in the house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you. And he's simply saying with the words except you, you're off bounds. And this was, in other words, here is Potiphar's wife who obviously holds her position lightly. But Joseph says, though you may hold it lightly, it's still a responsibility and I will recognize it. The third point that Joseph makes is the bottom line in the whole thing. And the bottom line is this. Sin against man, sin against man is always sin against God. Sin against man is sin against God. And that really is the way Joseph summarizes the whole situation. He had a very proper doctrinal view of sin. And that is stated. How can I do this great evil? This is the last, the closing remark to Potiphar's wife. How then can I do this great evil and sin against, and it's not her husband, though that's true. It's not against her, though that is true. But sin against God. Joseph knew how to take sin back to its roots. Now, Joseph responded to the continual harassment of this lady in two ways. He refused and took precaution. First, and they're both found in verse 10, now let me read the verse and simply end with refusal. It came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day that he did not listen to her to lie beside her, period. Now if that were all that was in verse 10, you would be saying in verse 10 that this is simply Joseph's refusal. But he did more than refuse. He took precaution. Notice the latter part after the comma in verse 10. Or be with her. Refusal plus precaution. Well, we have the response of Potiphar's wife, which is begins in verse 12 when he rises to flee. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me," and he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said, "See, he..." her husband has brought a Hebrew to us to make sport of us, and he came in to lie with me, and I screamed. So she takes the position of innocence, and of course she is believed by Potiphar apparently, and Joseph goes to prison. Very important thing. Life does not spare the innocent and often rewards the guilty. She was guilty. What happened to her? Nothing. Joseph was innocent. What happened to him? He went to jail. And so, as we said last time, we need to modify that little thing that sometimes crosses our mind, that if we play it right, if we're fair, if we do the right thing, God will reward that immediately. I imagine Joseph got... He had to have thoughts like this, I think. He had to get down there in jail and in his prayer saying, "God, I did the right thing. I said no. I honored your name. I got thrown in jail for it. That's not fair." And we can also add to that, coming at it from a different angle, since God is sovereign, couldn't God have spared him losing his garment? Couldn't God have spared him that incident? That horrible incident? Of course he could. But it's very important that it is the will of God that his children sometimes bear unjust and unfair treatment. And Joseph is a good example. Why would God allow his children to suffer unjust, unfair treatment? Why would God do that? A very simple reason. So we'll understand and have fellowship in the sufferings of Christ. Did Christ suffer? Did he ever once suffer justly? Never. And so that makes some sense then. Why would God allow this to happen to his children? So we can identify with the one man that is our Savior and suffered every suffering that he suffered unjustly. And therefore it is what Paul calls, remember, in the book of Philippians chapter 3, he wants to enter into the fellowship of his sufferings. And therefore Joseph, as he sits there in prison, is really fellowshipping in the coming suffering of the Messiah, because it's all unfair, it's all unjust, it's all cruel. Why doesn't he need to despair? Because it doesn't make any difference the nature of the event. All things God is able to make work together for good to them that love the Lord. By the way, notice this is the second time that he's thrown in prison or in a pit because he is faithful to his master. Joseph was sent out by his father, Jacob, to get a report of what was going on with his brothers. He carried it out faithfully, and he got thrown in a pit and sold into Egypt. I thought he would have become wise after that, but I'll think again the next time I am faithful to my master at such an expense. But this guy went and did it again. And while it was in the pit the first time, it's in prison this time, and in both cases it was due to faithfulness to the responsibility that was given to him. Well, we close the chapter then with Joseph in prison. Joseph's success in prison. Third part of the chapter, verses 20 through 23. And I close with two things that is established by this section. Number one, Joseph is now established that he did the right thing though he suffered for it. He did the right thing though he suffered for it. Notice he did not suffer for doing the wrong thing. He suffered because he did the right thing. And therefore that means that the issue in his mind, and it ought to always be in our minds, is not what are the consequences. Where might this lead? The issue is it right? Remember old Bob Jones Sr. Used to scream this at us over and over again. Do right until the stars fall. And he used to screech it, as a southern preacher could do, over and over again. So that the only issue was, is it right? If it's right, do it. And the consequences can be left to God. And Joseph had that kind of doing right mentality, and he did it, and in this case, he suffers for it. Of course, it was the path to the palace, and it was the path to being prime minister, because God is sovereign. Okay? This event is the, and I'll use the Romans 8:28 word, this is the sin ergo event that transitions him to the palace. Now we do have one other thing that does have to come in there, it is true, and that is the fact that, and I know, it just happened, that when she screamed and Joseph got thrown in prison, through a strange twist of fate, these baker and the cupbearer offended the king, and by a strange twist of fate, happened to get thrown in the same jail with Joseph. And through a strange twist of fate, they happen to have a dream. And strangely enough, Joseph could interpret the dream. One of them was put to death. The other one was advanced or taken back to his position. And when he was taken back to his position, he forgot all about Joseph and saying any good word for him until, through fate, the king had a dream. Then his memory was jogged. And his memory was jogged. He recalled Joseph in prison. Joseph was called from prison to interpret the dream of the Pharaoh, and from there on out, he is prime minister of Egypt. As we come down to chapter 45, the whole nation of Israel would have starved to death. All of his brothers would have starved to death if these horrible things had not happened to Joseph. And you stop to think of those brothers. Are they worth saving? They sold him. They wanted to kill him. And through Joseph suffering wrong deeds under the sovereignty of God, he was able to save the life of no good Reuben, no good Judah, no good rest of his brothers, because this man had the Romans 8:28 mentality, and he never complains. He simply functions in a way that honors God wherever he is, and that's the success of Joseph. Father, tonight we're thankful once again for your word. We pray that you'll help us to realize how much human viewpoint we really use, because we're always getting bent out of shape over unfair treatment, unjust treatment. We were lied about. We were misused. Instead of simply relaxing and recognizing that, yes, we are treated many times unfairly and unjustly, but this does not put up a roadblock before you, that you are very much on the throne and you're very much intimately and personally involved with your children when they are treated wrongly. We pray that we might learn from his attitude, in Christ's name.